There are many myths around coca. Every day, press accounts around the world use the word coca in their headlines. When in fact, they refer to cocaine. Coca is a plant with a complex array of mineral nutrients, essential oils, and different compounds with greater or lesser pharmacological effects. One of which happens to be the alkaloid cocaine, which in its concentrated, synthesized form is a strong stimulant. But coca is not cocaine. The coca leaf has been chewed and brewed for tea traditionally for thousands of years among indigenous peoples in the Andean Amazon region. And instead of causing harm, it is beneficial to human health. When chewed, coca acts as a mild stimulant and suppresses hunger, thirst, pain, and fatigue. It helps overcome altitude sickness. Coca chewing and drinking of tea is carried out daily by millions of people in the Andean Amazonian region for a variety of benefits and is considered sacred within several indigenous cultures. While the coca leaf in its natural form is a harmless and mild stimulant comparable to coffee, there's no doubt that cocaine can be extracted from the coca leaf. Without coca, there would be no cocaine. The ready extractability of cocaine from coca leaves is currently the major argument used to justify the current illegal status of the leaf in the 1961 Single Convention on Drugs. The inclusion of coca in the UN list of prohibited drugs has caused decades of indignation in the Andean region, and a historical correction is long overdue. The 1961 Single Convention enshrined the traditional Western view, which equates coca with cocaine and treats both in exactly the same way. A distinction needs to be made. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. I'm your host, Sean Macheza. To better understand what has been called the leaf of the gods, our guest on the podcast today will give us a deep dive into the history and significance of the coca leaf in the Andean Amazon region. Wade Davis is a Canadian cultural anthropologist, ethnobotanist, photographer, and writer. He's a professor of anthropology and the BC Leadership Chair in Cultures and Ecosystems at Risk at the University of British Columbia. He is multiple award-winning author of more than 25 books and has done extensive research into coca leaf among many other ethnobotanic explorations. This conversation constitutes the third issue of our Coca Chronicles series by the Transnational Institute and WOLA. And I highly recommend checking out the first two issues for more detailed context. I began by asking Wade to give us a brief history of the use of coca and to differentiate it from its much more concentrated extraction, the notorious cocaine.
Coca, of course, is a plant, two domesticated species, four different varieties that have been used by indigenous people throughout the Andes and Northwest Amazon for 8,000 years as a mild stimulant, essential in ritual behavior, key to the nutritional regime of the cultures. And the best way to distinguish it perhaps from cocaine is simply to say that, you know, coca is to cocaine what potatoes are to vodka. You know, there's no comparison. I mean, one of the reasons, Sean, that the initial confusion perhaps is that the very first drug ever isolated from a plant was morphine from opium poppies. And the second in 1859 was cocaine from the coca leaf. And because the deleterious effects of opium were obvious, it was assumed that not only was morphine a powerful drug, but the source plant was also a potentially hazardous natural product. And so there was the assumption that therefore coca had to be to, in a sense, cocaine, what opium poppies were to morphine, which is totally untrue. And the early efforts to eradicate coca began with the Spaniards, but they soon discovered that the indigenous people, even enslaved, could not produce in the mines without having access to the leaf. And because of that, in 1572, Toledo reversed the original prohibition on the leaf. And in fact, coca and coca production and distribution became the economic foundation of the Spanish realm. And coca, you know, we now know has been used for over 8,000 years with no sign of addiction, let alone toxicity. One of the fascinating things, Sean, about coca is that the efforts to eradicate the traditional fields, particularly in Peru, began fully 50 years before there was any black market of any significant size in cocaine. And it began, in a sense, less because of the pharmacology of the leaf than the cultural identity of those who revered the leaf. In the 1920s, physicians in Lima, public health officials, looked up into the Andes and they saw illiteracy, poor nutrition, various forms of what they defined to be social pathology, including rejection of the dominant and superior culture, as they described it, literally at the time. And they had to find a culprit. And because issues of economics, social justice, land distribution that were at the source of the challenges of the peoples of the Andes came too close to threatening, if you will, the foundations of their bourgeois lives in Lima, they settled on coca as a source of all ills. And so that when the first UN investigative bodies went to Peru to look into the so-called coca problem, they literally announced their results upon arrival at the airport in Lima. And the most amazing thing of all, Sean, is that during all those years of the demonization of coca, none of these officials, none of these public health officials, none of the physicians bothered to do the obvious, a simple nutritional study of the plant that could have been readily done. And it was, after all, a plant that was being used every day by 6 million of their fellow citizens in Peru. And when finally, through the Botanical Museum at Harvard in the 1970s, when we had a major project studying the taxonomy, the phylogeny, the ethnobotany, and of course, the medicinal potential and value of coca, we did the first nutritional study. And what we found horrified our backers, both at the U.S. government and in certain corridors of power in Peru, because it turns out that coca, yes, it has a small amount of the alkaloid, which is absorbed. It's not the same as the cocaine hydrochloride salt. It's a different a compound, but it's sort of like analogous to the amount of caffeine in a coffee bean. If you extracted caffeine and snorted it up your nose, you'd have a drug problem, right? But in addition to this very small amount of the alkaloid, half to 1% dry weight, absorbed benignly by the mucous membrane of the mouth as a completely legitimate mild stimulant in a harsh environment, coca was full of nutrients. It had huge proteins, a plethora of vitamins. It had more calcium than any plant ever studied by science, which made it perfect for a traditional diet in the Andes, particularly that lacked a dairy product. The plant even had enzymes which enhanced the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation, again, perfect for the tuber-based diet of the Andes. So in one simple, elegant nutritional assay that could have been done in the 1920s or 30s, we put into stark profile all of these efforts, the draconian efforts to eradicate the traditional fields, and showed that this was a plant that had been used with no evidence of toxicity, let alone addiction, for thousands of years. And in fact, even more importantly than its role in nutrition, was the fact that it was the foundation, the glue that held together the cosmology, the religion, the entire way of life of the Andean people. You know, in the Peruvian...
But tell me a little more about that, about how the coca affected in people's daily life. I mean, you've described its positive attributes, what the plant does, but what other meanings did the plant have to the people of
the Andes? I mean, if you go back, not just to the Inca, but to all the pre-Incaic civilizations in the Andes. In fact, we've recently done a survey with my good friend Susie Mejia and her team in Medellin, Colombia, and you cannot find virtually a single culture through the prehistory, not just of Peru, but of Bolivia, Argentina, Ecuador, Colombia, and all the way north to Costa Rica, that did not revere and use this plant. We know that in the time of the Inca, armies were marched across deserts because of the plant. We know that you could not approach a holy shrine if you did not have coca in your mouth. If you had coca in your mouth at the time of your passing, you were assured an ascent to the paradise. And so it played into every single aspect of Andean life. And in fact, today in the fields in the Andes, you wake up in the morning and you bless the tools and you bless the fields and you sprinkle coca on the fields and you sprinkle coca on the tools when you come home. When you meet people on the trail, you don't shake hands, you exchange leaves, three perfect leaves in a cruceta, which is then lifted up and pointed to the sacred mountain, the deities, the apus that are said to dominate every community. And as you blow the essence of the leaf to the mountaintop, you're essentially blowing the essence of the leaves to Pachamama, such that the energy will rise the mountain and descend just as the clouds condense into rain to bring fertility to the fields. Distance in the Andes is measured not in kilometers or miles, but in cocadas, coca chews, how many coca chews to get here. In the Sierra Nevada, Santa Marta, in the northern Caribbean coastal plain of Colombia, the elder brothers, the Wiwa, the Kogi, the Kankuano, and the Arawakos, the use of coca is in every single aspect of their lives. Men will chew a pound of leaves a day. The entire, it's a meditation. You know, if you think of, you know, an anthropologist famously quipped that, you know, the difference between cocaine and coke is the difference between traveling by jet plane and traveling by mule. But it's a clever line, but it misses an essential point, which is that the coca experience is completely different. I mean, cocaine is all about ego. It's all about saying that I've arrived. It's all about, you know, a public display of consumptive wealth and greed. To me, it's always stunning. I've always really hated cocaine, and not simply because it's a lousy drug and makes people into ugly people. But it also, of course, has been responsible for a real war, not a war on drugs, a real war that has led to the death of 400,000 Colombians, the displacement of 7 million Colombians, 5 million Colombians being forced to leave their homes. How would America feel if Canada had patterns of drug consumption of cocaine in boards and bar rooms across the country and laws that did nothing but encourage the black market trade and sanctions that did nothing to curb that trade, such that 85 million Americans would be forced to flee their homes? Well, that's what happened in Colombia. In Colombia, a country of 50 million people, there were never more than 300,000 combatants in a 50-year war that wouldn't have lasted a day without the sordid profits of prohibition. In all seriousness, the coke is not a drug, it's a meditation. It's a moment in time when you stop, you gather. It could be in the Moloka in the Northwest Amazon, or it could be in a field as you gather to work together in a cooperative way. And one of the really fascinating things about coca, Sean, is that if you look in the literature, particularly of the 19th century, travelers, physicians who were experiencing coca without judgment, you know, in an atmosphere that was free of ideology preconceptions, it's really fascinating because they're sort of always saying, you know, I don't really get it. It seems to be a stimulant, but it doesn't feel like a stimulant because I didn't really sense anything. All I sensed was that I could go 8 hours and stay focused and concentrated and slightly allay my hunger and have an added amount of energy. I mean, there's a very funny anecdote in a classic book called The History of Coca, published by Mortimer in 1901, where the head of the British Medical Association takes some students across the hills of Scotland. And he's like 79 at the time, and he decides to experiment with chewing coca. And he goes all the way across, like 19 miles walking, climbs a couple mountains, and he sort of gets back to the inn at night and says, well, that was interesting. I never got hungry. I never locked my inn. And there's another really funny one from the 1877 World Championship lacrosse game in Toronto. And there are two teams, one made up of kind of Canadian bushmen from, you know, the outback, and the other a bunch of clerks from the inner city of Toronto. And you'd expect, of course, the lumberjacks to win. And it's a very hot, sticky day. But of course, the clerks from the inner city, who are completely out of shape, are the ones who endure and eventually win the championship. And the only difference is that they were all chewing coca. And, you know, again, you know, all joking aside, I mean, one of the things that I think is so sad about the demonization of coca is not only that it's false, and not only that it denies Latin America its greatest gift to the world, but it also denies all of us the chance to experience and benefit from this incredibly benign and useful stimulant. You know, I mean, of all the natural stimulants we have, coca is without doubt the most effective and benign. You know, you can't write
when you describe it, it sounds, I mean, I would like at some point to try some. When you describe it, when you describe also the cultural practices around it, I think of an Ethiopian coffee ceremony. I think of a Japanese tea ceremony. I think of these moments of taking a moment to experience the preparation and the consumption of the beverage.
But I would go further, Sean, and I think you're absolutely right. And it is certainly analogous to the use of coffee in Ethiopia, but there's a difference. In other words, for all of its elegance of the tea ceremony, or the coffee and or beer for that matter in Germany, you could take those stimulants, or in the case of beer, that soporific, away from the culture, and the culture wouldn't collapse. But in the case of coca, to take away coca and deny people coca really is an act of cultural genocide, because it's
that fundamental to the culture.
That fundamental. I mean, you cannot be of the Andes and not use the plant. And the other thing about coca, which is so interesting and difficult to explain to people, is just how useful it is. You know, if I were to say to you, in this age of ours where most of us are forced in whatever our vocations to spend hours at a time looking at a screen, you know, concentrating, whatever our professions, if I told you there was a substance you could take in the morning and chew all day, and it just sort of took a little bit away that existential malaise. You know, we always talk about, you know, how the new revolution in psychedelics or cannabis. And I mean, the truth of the matter is cannabis remains a pretty lousy drug, in my opinion, you know, but that's just my opinion. It's called dope for a reason. It ruins parties. And I certainly don't want, you know, I never wanted my kids to be mellow. You know, the word mellow is actually means in English a state of overripe fruit. I don't think any of us want our kids to be mellow. But that aside, you know, the potential of some of the psychedelics is clear, but it's limited. You know, whereas the one thing that all of us, certainly in the West, suffer from is a kind of existential malaise. You know, you get up in the morning, you haven't gotten that report done, you got to get your kids off to school, you kind of, you know, maybe you drank a little bit too much wine last night, or maybe you just didn't sleep well, you know, and you kind of trudge off to work. Well, if I told you there was a completely benign, mild stimulant that had been used safely for 8,000 years, revered by countless civilizations and contemporary indigenous communities, that just lifted your spirits just slightly, almost imperceptibly, put a little bit of a bounce in your foot, and somehow allowed you to get to your cubicle at work and be rather unusually content to be there, And suddenly you found that without having any sense whatsoever of having any kind of stimulation, nothing even as strong as a series of cups of coffee in you. But suddenly at the end of the day, you realized you had been able to focus all day, remain content and concentrated all day. And at that moment when you suddenly had to write that first line of that report, you suddenly realized and noticed that you hadn't been inhibited quite as before. And you just sort of effortlessly, you knew what you needed to say, so you just said it. And at the end of the day, you went home completely content, went for a run, for a walk with your kids, had dinner with your partner or whatever, and maybe watched a little bit of telly and went to bed. And guess what? You could do it again the next day and find at the end of that day, you were just as productive. And once again, you noticed that you'd been more productive and more content than before you started using this plant. Wouldn't that be interesting? I mean, wouldn't that be?
If I had that, and I had access to something that does that, and then someone takes it away from me, I think I wouldn't be happy about it.
Well, the point is that they've been taking it away from us for half a century in this idiotic war on drugs. And today,
you mentioned that the Spanish came and tried to stop it, and then realized that it's too fundamental to these people's way of life. So
they didn't give a shit. They didn't give a damn about the people's way of life. They were enslaving the indigenous people who were dying by the score. But in the mines of Huancavelica and Potosi in Bolivia, they found that production just collapsed if the indigenous people didn't have coca, simply because coca, in a perverse way in that time, augmented and facilitated work as much as it did in pre-Columbian times, as much as it does in the field of Andes today, as much as it does in my office here when I'm writing my books, right? So it was it was a purely practical, but then once they did begin to openly market coca, it became massive production and the foundation of the colonial economy and the foundation of the power of the church in the 17th and 18th century. One of the other really interesting things about coca, we haven't really talked about the plant, you know, and it's a beautiful, delicate shrub with small white flowers and red fruits the size and color of rubies. But the most interesting thing about it is that there are two main domesticated species, Erythroxylum novogranitense, which is the coca of Colombia, and Erythroxylum coca, which is the coca of Peru and Bolivia, the classic coca of the Inca. Mm-hmm. And each of those has two varieties. One is called Erythroxylum novogranitense variety tuyense, which is a Colombian coca that was brought down into the northern deserts of Peru. And that's incidentally the coca that is still sourced by Coca-Cola that imports 150 tons of it every year from Peru legally, the only legal importer of coca in North America. And then the coca of Peru and Bolivia went down the Amazon and into the northwest, down the Amazon River, the Ucayali, into the northwest Amazon of what is today Colombia. And there began a different preparation called mambe or ipadu, and it's planted there by cuttings and propagated vegetatively. But here's the interesting story. In the 1970s, when we studied coca, we were trying to figure out where the plant had originated. And based on certain morphological features of the flower that are botanical signs, if you will, we concluded that the coca of Colombia, again, for a number of morphological traits, was derived from the coca of Peru, and we published on that and so on. But we were wrong, because DNA analysis has revealed a much more incredible story. It turns out that both the coca of Colombia and the coca of Bolivia are derived from the same ancestor, a wild species called Erythroxylum gracilipes, which grows the length of the Andean Cordillera. And what this means, Sean, and there's no precedent to this that I can think of in the history of agriculture, where the same wild ancestor has been identified 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers apart by different civilizations, domesticated for the same traits, brought into the agricultural toolkit of the civilization, and in both areas revered as the divine leaf of immortality, the essence of the god. I mean, that's an amazing
independent of each other.
What?
Independent of each other.
Totally independent of each other. It's an amazing example of artificial selection and domestication at the extremes of the range of a wild plant. So this just speaks to the depth and importance of this plant in history. And you know, it's interesting, you know, we've had this war on drugs for 50 years. It was completely a political invention of Richard Nixon to win the 1972 election and to isolate what he saw as a deviant, students, black people, radicals, whatever, to create this fantasy of the silent majority, right? We know from
Talk about that a little deeper. Are we talking about cocaine there, or are we talking about coca?
No, we're talking about
get to be made
in that sense, we're talking about the war on drugs in general. Now, just to jump back, remember I mentioned that cocaine was the second pure alkaloid or pure drug to be isolated from a plant. And that was 1859. And not long after that, people discovered its powerful utility as a topical anesthetic. And to this day, cocaine remains our most powerful topical anesthetic, especially for nose, throat, and ear surgery, you know, perfectly illustrating the adage that there's no such thing as good and bad drugs. There are only good and bad ways of using drugs. And cocaine was seen as a panacea. And in the 1870s and 1880s, you could purchase cocaine in any number of products, right? And famously, Freud, in his misguided monograph on coca, described it as a treatment for morphine addiction. And of course, it turned out that the treatment could be as bad as the disease, if you will. And so once people realized how hazardous cocaine could become, the reversal of fortunes was immediate. And cocaine went from being seen as a panacea to being a demonic, product of the devil, conveniently used mostly by black people. I mean, that was sort of the reversal of fortunes was immediate. But before then, cocaine had been heralded. I mean, that was the whole genesis of Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola began with a Corsican chemist by the name of Mariani, who combined red Bordeaux wine with coca leaf extract for the flavonoids, the flavoring agents, and pure cocaine hydrochloride. And it was a zippy beverage, and not surprisingly, it was a big hit. I mean, he was the only one responsible for turning on several U.S. presidents, the Pope, several monarchs, the rabbi of Paris, the Shah of Iran, to cocaine.
Wow.
It was the most popular beverage in the world, and there were a lot of imitators. And one in Atlanta began to concoct something called the French tonic, which became Coca-Cola. And the beverage was extraordinarily popular, but then with the growing temperance movement, Kellogg and the Mineral Springs of the Midwest, they wisely removed the alcohol and substituted bubbly water. That's why we have it as a soda water. And because of the imminent Harrison Pure Drug and Food and Drug Act of 1916, I think it was, they saw that prohibition of cocaine was coming down the pipe. So they took out the cocaine and substituted the cola nut of Africa to give it a little boost of caffeine. And that's how we have Coca-Cola. And that's why, for example, you're too young, Sean, probably to remember, but when I was growing up, if you went to a Woolworth's drugstore with your mom, there was always a soda fountain there, right? And it was, if you think of why is there a soda fountain selling, soft drinks and milkshakes in a drugstore? Well, the answer is because originally the soda fountain was kind of a poor man's health spa. And you went in there and you ordered a shot in the arm, which was a euphemism for a Coca-Cola. And it was a very kind of powerful and delightful beverage, right? And because of that legacy, to this day, as I mentioned, Coca-Cola is the only legal importer of coca. And what they do is they extract the cocaine, sell it on the legal pharmaceutical market, but they keep the flavonoids and other agents in the mixture. And that's why Coke really can claim, as the advertising slogans have always professed, to be the real thing. And so to this day, the Stepan Chemical Company in New Jersey does all that processing. So Coca-Cola has access to coca leaves, but not the rest of us.
So now the turn in fortunes for cocaine comes about, and then you have the United Nations coming up now and trying to schedule drugs and having an international global approach to how we deal with drugs, right? The regulation. And in 1961, coca becomes scheduled as a Schedule One drug, which essentially means it's the bad drugs, essentially. What impact does this have on people in the Andean region?
Well,
does this come about, actually? How does this happen when from what you've described, it sounds to me like coca is an extremely benign, pleasant drug with very few harmful effects, but it's Schedule One.
Well, actually, the interesting thing is that coca is actually Schedule Two, the leaves. In other words, Schedule Two means drugs that have a potential danger but have known medicinal properties. And even the FDA and the DEA couldn't deny that to coca. So technically speaking, a doctor could prescribe coca leaves in North America, or at least in the United States. The problem is that A, there's no supply, and B, there's no protocol, and C, there haven't been the possibility for the kind of clinical and medical trials that are necessary to bring any substance to market. But you really hit the nail on the head, Sean. You know why did this demonization? And a lot of it was, again, because you had this sort of, Peru in particular has always been a country and remains a country of conquered and conqueror, and the power of Lima and those physicians and those public health officials who looked up into the Andes, as I mentioned, their concern for the well-being of Andean peoples was matched in its intensity only by their ignorance of Andean life, right? You can see it in their commentaries and their dubious studies done in prisons and so on. The distortions were so transparent. I mean, they complained that coca users had a poor attitude towards the superior culture. I mean, it's so obvious. And of course, when the UN officials went down there in 48, 51, and so on, this is right at the height of America's kind of march to the hemisphere, if you will. And, and all that sort of post-war, let's improve the lives of the Latin American people. And, the Rockefeller Foundation going down, agricultural projects. And there was this sort of sense of being able to sweep into a nation and prescribe its proper path forward, and not just in a military political sense. And so they found natural allies in these really completely culturally insensitive and frankly arrogant bourgeois medical authorities in Lima, who just completely looked down their noses at the people of the Andes and saw nothing to respect in that culture. I mean, mercifully, Peru, like all Latin American countries and all countries in the world, has had a total reversal of that kind of sentiment, and indigenous people are now finally being seen as just nations, nations deserving to have a place at the table of human wisdom, if you will. But back then, it's hard to remember how the contempt that was had for indigenous people of the Andes. And so that played out in this demonization of coca that was so carefully associated with it. But there's another thing that goes on that might be even more politically charged, if you will. I remember, you ask yourself, why is it that after spending $1 trillion on this misguided war on drugs, there are more people using worse drugs in worse ways than ever before? And this is not a trivial issue, because until we somehow eliminate the money and the corruption that has risen because of this illicit trade, countries like Colombia will never have a chance for true and fundamental stability and peace. It's important to remember that, in the last year before the peace agreement was signed by President Juan Manuel Santos and the leaders of FARC in Havana, the FARC were down to about 6,000 cadre, mostly, and the FARC, of course, were the one of the leftist revolutionary groups that had been fighting in Colombia for so long. But they had long lost any kind of revolutionary or legitimacy in terms of political fervor. They were just running rackets like everybody else. And in the last year, down to 6,000 cadre, mostly just young women and men in search of four meals a day, they nevertheless made $800 million through extortion and drugs. Well, you give me the Boy Scouts of Amsterdam and $800 million, and I can wreak havoc in the Netherlands. And so the scale of the money was so extraordinary. I mean, to give you an idea, at the height of the Medellin cartel, which was essentially the Ochoa brothers and Escobar, budgeted each week $1,000 to buy elastic bands. I just think
just to extort the money,
just to wrap the money. You know, wow. So one of the things that people don't understand about prohibition is that the fuel driving the illicit trade is not the drug, it's the money, right? And if you eliminate the money, I suspect the entire trade would implode. And this is a key to understanding why, after 50 years, we are still fighting with no end in sight, this hideous war. When I came back in 1975 from South America, I had been very fortunate to be the field assistant of a great botanist, Tim Plowman, the protege of the legendary ethnobotanist Richard Everett Schultes, who became my professor when Tim passed away. And Tim and I spent 2 years in South America on this large grant provided by the U.S. government, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, to study the, you know, this most important plant. Because the amazing thing is, when we began that research, nothing had been written about coca really since 1901. And yet here was this plant that was just beginning to convulse the whole world with this illicit product and so on. So when I came back in 1975, Tim said to me, there's a job at the USDA I want you to apply for, but if you take the job, I'll kill you. Well, I thought that was, Sean, that was an interesting kind of a guidance from a man that I considered my oldest brother, my only brother at that time, as if he was my, right? He was my mentor, my best friend, and so on. So anyway, I go out to the USDA in Beltsville, Maryland. I find this office of this corpulent bureaucrat, and I take one look at him, and I can tell that he's got nothing to do with agriculture. He's DEA head to toe. And the first thing I notice about him is he's a drug addict. I can't get in the office for the cigarette smoke. The second thing I notice is that the entire office is cluttered with seized drug paraphernalia. It's like going to the office of an anti-pornographer and finding the walls papered with pornography. And then I sit across from him, and this is the 1970s. So again, Sean, you're too young to remember how horrible the clothing was then, but he had a big butterfly collar, big red chest, gold chains, you can't make this stuff up. He tells me what the job is, and all they had figured out from our incredible research, not mine, Tim's, that had shown what amazing plant this was and all the nutritional value and all the importance and color. All they had figured out is that Tim and I were good at finding coca fields. And what he wanted me to do is go back to South America, get into these coca fields, and collect any biological pests that predated on coca leaves, bring it back so they could muck with it in a lab and make it more voracious and virulent and reintroduce it to South America. And I can't believe my eyes and my ears. And then I'm looking at this guy, and I suddenly realize, you know, well, how do I know this guy? I mean, I just swear I know him. And only when I left the office, having clearly declined any interest in the position, it dawned on me that I had never actually met him, but I knew him well, because I lived in Medellin when the cartel was just emerging in the early 1970s. And we would run into these people. I mean, Carlos Leder had a finca right up the road from us. And you know, if the sordid and bloody nature of the fratricidal drug war and trade was not yet obvious, the character of these people certainly was. I mean, these were sleazeballs, right? Mm-hmm. And I realized in that moment that the guy in that office was them. In other words, their energy was
the same person.
Same. They were two sides of the same coin. And neither side, of course, had any interest whatsoever in ending the war on drugs. Obviously, the cartels would lose their huge profit margins. And indeed, consumption of the drug might plummet because people would suddenly realize there was no allure to a drug that was analogous to the anesthetics that your dentist gave you when he ripped out a tooth. But of course, the DEA had no interest in winning the war or ending the war either, because they would be out on the street looking for work. And the drug budget year in and year out is something like $60 billion. And every part of the American government gets a piece of that pie. And no one wants this to end.
No one wants the tap to close. Yeah.
So the only people, everybody else wants the war on drugs to end. President Santos, who had been President Uribe's Minister of Defense, is a very good friend of mine. He made me an honorary citizen of Colombia, a great honor. But on a recent podcast, he said to me, you know, no one in history has done more to eradicate coca fields than I have. And it was all a mistake, right? And he's called for the cleansing stroke of legalization. Legalization is the only rational solution because it takes the problem from Colombia and puts the problem here. You know, why should we continue to export our problem? The fact that our citizens, and I'm not speaking of the Dutch, I'm speaking really of North Americans here. If our citizens are so alienated, so disturbed, so lonely in their office cubicles and glass towers that they want to use this drug called cocaine, well, that's a problem that we have to solve here. We have no
as
right.
As long as there's a market,
we have no export. We have no right to export that problem to Colombia, a country of 50 million people, where most people have never seen, let alone used, cocaine. Right, but that's what we've been doing for all of these years. It's a public health problem that should be solved where the public health crisis is, and that's in North America. Meanwhile, we need the cleansing stroke of liberation, and one of the things we're trying very hard to do, Sean, is to legally distinguish and separate coca leaves from cocaine, because we can't control whether or not cocaine becomes legal. When I say I'm in favor of legalizing cocaine, it's not because I'm in favor of cocaine. It's that I just think that the only way we can destroy this trade is through destroying the profit motive and the money.
Yeah.
And the truth is, I think once we do that, you'll find that drug use will plummet. Simply because it's such a lousy drug. And I personally, in my life,
they won't have the status symbol of being the expensive drug.
And I've been around the drug scene, although I'm not a drug user, but with our museum at Harvard, having been the world center for the study of medicinal, toxic and hallucinogenic plants. I mean, I've been around the drug scene, you know, since I was a teenager. And I also, of course, I'm a child of the 60s, and I've never met anybody whose decision to use or not use illicit drugs has ever had anything to do with their legal status, right? It just doesn't happen. So people have already, you know, there are good and bad ways of using drugs. And one good way of using drugs is abstinence. So people have already made their decisions about cocaine. You know, people can get cocaine in any street corner of North America, and they don't because they know it's not a good idea. So if cocaine was legal, I really don't think you'd see this flood of people who had previously abstained rushing out to use this drug. And meanwhile, we know that the known consequences of prohibition are dire. And what we're trying to do is separate coca and cocaine for the moment to create a legal nutraceutical market for coca leaves, which, if given a chance, I honestly think, purely because of the greater usefulness and effectiveness of the leaves than any other of our natural stimulants, from mate to tea to coffee, would dwarf those markets in short order.
Wow.
And above all, therefore, generate for Colombia the tax revenue to pay the costs of peace, having drained its treasury for 50 years to pay the sordid costs of a war that wouldn't have lasted a day had it not been for the profits of prohibition. Were coca to be available to the general consumer, I suspect it would get a lot of people off of tobacco, off of coffee, who people drink coffee in excess, but also off of cocaine, and provide people with a completely legitimate and benign natural stimulant, far better for you, far more efficacious, and far more nutritious than any of the stimulants that we use. And by the way, you know, it's interesting, you know, the history of coffee is kind of analogous. You know, coffee began in Abyssinia as a medicinal plant. It then entered domesticated use, but it was very controversial. I mean, in the remnants of the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan used to go around at night and cut off the heads of anyone who were caught using coffee. In many ways, coffee was...
But why?
Well, because it was subversive, you know. I mean, whenever new drugs or new stimulants come into a culture, they provoke anxiety. The French Revolution was caused by caffeine. Now, that may sound crazy, but until the mid-17th century, you couldn't drink the water in any European city if you didn't want to get cholera or dysentery. And so the entire continent was mildly besotted on alcohol. People drank wine, they drank beer, they drank mead, spirits. And suddenly, within 30 years, three central nervous system stimulants came into Europe: chocolate from Guatemala, coffee from Abyssinia, and eventually from the tropical countries of the New World, and of course, tea from China and India. And all of these products had to be made with boiled water. So that took care of the pathogen problem. And because they were precious commodities, they were sold in houses that became centers of intellectual discourse and intrigue. The coffee houses of Europe, of England, were known as penny universities. And that was because you could pay a penny and walk in and hear discourse from Christopher Wren or, you know, the great leading thinkers of the time. If you look at the literature of England in the 17th century, you know, Jonathan Swift, Samuel Pepys, Dryden, you know, it's just infused with caffeine. And in France, these coffee houses became center of political intrigue. I mean, suddenly, instead of being in your local tavern with your brow and your beer, you're wired on caffeine and you couldn't shut up.
You're totally away.
Versailles is a little bit more bigger than my place. And in fact, the mob that stormed the Bastille left began at Voltaire's favorite coffee house, the Café de Foy, right? And then what happened?
Redefines the meaning of woke.
Well, then what happened is that, you know, it was all well and good to be drinking beer and working a field, but with the Industrial Revolution, you couldn't operate a machine tool if you're mildly besotted on beer. And so coffee and tea became like steam and coal, engines of the Industrial Revolution. And the tea break or the coffee break, which was nothing more than an opportunity to take a moment to rest and imbibe another dose of the drug, was institutionalized and in every church priory, in every factory. And so the drug itself, which of course was caffeine, was domesticated. Like if you take caffeine addicted rats, they will tear their flesh apart to get more caffeine. So it's not about the drug. Caffeine was then domesticated as coffee and tea and redefined. And instead of being demonized in the way that, say, coca was, it was domesticated to the point where we don't even think of it as a stimulant or a drug, but it certainly is. And so, you know, we can, in fact, if we could just shift the attitude about coca, we'd suddenly find ourselves having a stimulant that is both better for us, as I say, nutritious and more effective. Yeah.
So could we replicate that? And I know, for instance, that Bolivia has made a presentation at the United Nations to say, well, this leaf is important for us culturally. I mean, there's generally a trend of newly discovering indigenous forms of knowledge, indigenous wisdom, respecting them, and finding new ways of incorporating them into in, into the world, right? And Bolivia has taken the lead there and said, well, coca leaf is important for our tradition and our culture. And they've made presentations at the United Nations to say, is it a possibility to reschedule this drug and make it available? I mean, just for the local people to use it and also maybe available internationally. Do you think it might have the same trajectory as you just described with coffee, where I think in the future walk in and ask for a couple of coca leaves on my way to the office?
Well, you know, I think, obviously, as a pure aside, if we're going to market coca, we'll have to find a delivery system. I mean, most consumers aren't going to want to put dry leaves in their mouths, but it could be presented as a chewing gum or some other. That's not a problem. The Bolivia has taken the lead. And Morales, of course, the president, was famously a coca in the coca traditional market business. And certainly there's a very strong feeling in Colombia. There's a feeling throughout Latin America that you know, it's time that the continent, in a way, its greatest gift to the world should no longer be denied. In a way, it's an insult that it has been denied in this way. The problem is that it's not going to happen in the United States. The United States can't agree to do anything these days. And the drugs and the devil and communism are kind of one force in the American imagination, you know. But you know, what's interesting is contrast it with marijuana, for example. I find it simply astonishing that a plant that not 10 years ago could ruin, you know, getting caught with one joint of marijuana when I was a kid could ruin your life. I mean, Timothy Leary famously spent months in solitary confinement in San Quentin maximum security prison, having been arrested for possession of one joint of marijuana. And now in places like Canada, you have marijuana shops in every street corner. I don't necessarily think that's a sign that we've learned anything about drug use. I mean, marijuana remains a very powerful drug, and with varieties that are more powerful than anything we experienced when we were young. And I find it kind of curious that that drug has been so readily embraced, but coca remains demonized. Again, it gets into the whole thing about the policy shift, not because of the initiatives of politicians, but when politicians are driven by their voters. You know, politicians follow, they never lead for the most part. And it was only demand that eventually led to the decriminalization and then the legalization of marijuana in a place like Canada. And what we need to do with coca is build up a similar constituency, but it's hard to do when people don't have access to the plant. But I think that there's this growing sense in Latin America of people just fed up. You know, they're just fed up of their culture and their nation and their people being torn asunder by a war that they cannot control as long as those profits are there. So there is a movement, but I think it's gonna be in places perhaps like the Netherlands or Canada that coca will find an opening. And once it does in a number of particularly Western European or Canada or perhaps Australia, then people will get what all the excitement's about, and it will move into the United States in time.
Well, thank you so much, Wade. Do you have any other thoughts that we may have not explored right now? Any parts of this story that you feel we didn't touch on?
No, I think, Sean, I think we've covered a lot of it. I mean, you know, I feel very strongly personally that in memory of my friend Tim, who was devoted his entire life to understanding this most mysterious and sacred plant. And I remember it was when Tim died very young, at the age of 45, and I was given the eulogy at the service in the Field Museum. And it was at that time that I decided to tell a book that would record his contributions, if you will. And that book came out 6 years later. It's called One River. And there's quite a bit of on coca in that if people are interested. But right now I'm very keen to write a proper book on coca, just to, you know, purely with no reference, no mention of cocaine, but simply a pure celebration of the wonder of this plant. And it's really time. It's not about legalizing coca, it's about liberating coca. And that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to anthropologist and professor Wade Davis. This episode is part of the Coca Chronicles, where TNI and the Washington Office on Latin America are keeping track of the process where the World Health Organization, at Bolivia's initiative and supported by Colombia, will conduct a critical review of the coca leaf beginning this year. The first step will be a study undertaken by the WHO Expert Committee on Drug Dependence, based on the available scientific literature, inputs from treaty parties, including the dossier that Bolivia already submitted, and contributions from civil society organizations. Depending on the findings of its study, the expert committee will then submit any recommended changes in coca's classification to the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, the CND, which is the Vienna-based UN drug policy body. The 53 countries that are members of the CND would then vote on the recommendations, with a simple majority required for approval. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights recently warned that the current drug control model, I quote, perpetuates existing patterns of discrimination, including against people of African descent, women, and indigenous peoples, and calling to end the war on drugs and to focus on transformative change, crafting drug policies which are based on evidence and which put human rights at their center, end quote. An evidence-based review of the classification of the coca leaf is an important step towards transforming a treaty system that appears frozen in time. A rescheduling of coca can restore the dignity and lawful right to the people that consume coca leaf for traditional and medicinal purposes to legally exercise this cultural and harmless practice. The coca review process can also help modernize a drug treaty system still mired in the colonialist biases and racial prejudices from which it arose in the mid-20th century, and to open legal international markets for natural coca products, bringing coca's benefits to increasing numbers of people around the world. For 50 years, TNI has served as a unique nexus between social movements, engaged scholars, and policymakers. Join us as we celebrate our half a century birthday. Please check our website for the relevant details. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate the podcast on whichever platform you're listening from. And please write us a review, which can really help us to get better at what we do. If you would like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.